Let's just talk. Okay, starting all over again. the Buddha said when something causes stress or suffering, when we're disappointed, frustrated, something occurs in life that we're unhappy about, the normal person goes through two stages. The first is confusion as to what caused it. We generally tend to blame the world or people around us or blame things beyond our control. And then the second thing we do is look for something out in the world that will immediately make the suffering go away. We'll immediately solve it. And this tendency to look for all of our peace and our happiness and our security and our sense of purpose outside of ourselves is something that starts, of course, very young. When we're children, when we're cold, we cry out and somebody brings us a blanket. When we're hungry, people bring us food, hopefully, unless you are raised by inconsiderate parents. And so we get this general draft that when we're lonely, when we feel vulnerable, we cry and somebody comes rushing up. And so it starts this pattern for looking for a sense of affirmation and a sense of purpose in our lives and a sense of not being lost and for a sense of being okay. All these things we look for from other people. We look from our very sense of, I'm okay, aren't I? I have a role in this world, don't I? I have a purpose, and I'm not unusual. Please tell me I'm good. And so all of this, this tendencies, of course, takes this tendency to find the answers outside too far, because a lot of these things we're looking for solutions for cannot be answered out by other people. You cannot find your sense of inner worthiness, inner peace cannot be given to you by somebody else. It's not something that the world can give you. Inner peace, a sense of a purpose, a sense of being okay with yourself, all these things that we're constantly looking for from other people, they can't give it to you. At best, they can give you a short-term feel-good bump. But eventually, that bump that you get is going to go away, and you're going to be left again with the same inner feelings of what's the point? You know, why do I feel stressed out? Why do I feel incomplete? What is my purpose here? What am I doing? All those questions, they can't be answered for you by other people. It actually, the great answers come from within, which is one of the reasons why it's funny. People think that the Buddha said that there's no God. The Buddha didn't say that, but his clear point of view on the issue was that deities, gods, they're all very fine and good if they exist, but they cannot help you in the most important areas where we need help. Nothing outside of yourself can be the thing that can bring you inner peace, tranquility, a sense of self-esteem, a sense of lasting happiness. No God or other person can do that for you. You have to do that for yourself. So this thing, though, this tendency to flow outside of ourselves into the world looking for the solution, make me feel good, make me feel calm, make me feel happy, make me feel secure in how I'm using my life. This is called by the Buddha asava, A-S-A-V-A. And it's the stressful flowing out in the world looking for a short-term thing. It could be approval from others. It could be monetary gain. It could be feeling famous and having a lot of friends on Facebook. It could be sensual pleasures. Those are the four winds that blow us about. We're constantly looking for people to say we're good, popularity, monetary gain and security, and sensual pleasures. All these things to make us, to distract us, really, from the stress and the sense of emptiness and the sense of Why am I here? What am I doing? What's the point? Why do I feel so alone? Why do I feel this or that? We're looking for the answer out there. And of course the answer comes from within. But so there's this tendency of asava, flowing outside of ourselves. And one of the great tools the Buddha gave to ward off this tendency is, of course, mindfulness, which is training the mind to focus within. And one of the tools that helps us with mindfulness is restraint. And I'm going to be talking about that. Restraint is in English is such a sort of negative sounding word. It brings to mind being in a hospital gurney with like things locking you down. It sounds like, oh my God, that sounds unfun, right? Nobody looks forward to restraint. You know, where's the fun part of this path, you know? And there are lots of, you know, tools that sound a hell of a lot more fun than restraint, but a restraint is actually a lot different than what you think. I'm going to talk about what restraint is, and it's a lot easier to practice than how it sounds. And it's a very, very valuable tool for developing peace of mind, for quieting the mind when it's agitated, constantly looking around for, you know, where am I going to find, you know, the solution? And or, on the other hand, feeling completely beaten down by the world, where everything's stressing us out. Practicing restraint is really, really an important tool to develop. The Buddha used the metaphor to explain restraint of feeding. He said that the mind feeds on the world, much like the body feeds on food. The mind feeds on sensations. It feeds on the motivations behind our searching, and it feeds on just the mood or the state of mind that we're in, but it really feeds on the sensations of the world, the Buddha said. It's trying to feed, looking for something to fill it up. It's trying to feed on approval, feed on people saying we're good, feed on you know, getting a sense of okayness from others, feed on on people liking what we do at work, feed on people saying, oh, you're really good, you know. So we're feeding on this, and that's like the mind is looking to fill up that sense of emptiness, that sense of pointlessness, that sense of perhaps despair or sadness or whatever we're feeling. It's trying to feed on the world of approval and popularity and sensual pleasures and just the feeling of gain and owning things. It's trying to feed on these things to make us feel secure, right? So there's that metaphor. And of course, the more we're feeding on the world, if we feed on something that's poisonous, we're going to become sick. I mean, not literally physically sick, but more often mentally sick. If we feed on the words of people who are unskillful, then you're going to have an unskillful mind because you're feeding on the thoughts of other people. I once got a tattoo from a guy who had nearly his entire leg and a huge part of his body was tattooed black. And I asked him why. And he said, well, when I was a young guy, I was surrounded by, you know, sort of a gang of neo-Nazis and we all got swastikas on us. I'm like, wow, dude, you actually got a swastika tattooed on you. I'm glad you got that covered up, man. I would not want to get a tattoo from a guy with a swastika. My Jewish mother would be thrilled by that. No, but anyway, we can feed on approval and a sense of okay, and people who are, there's all these clinical studies about how people will do things completely against their moral code just by peer pressure. The famous Yale study right after World War II, where they got people to administer what they thought were fatal electric shocks to people in the other room because people in the same room were saying, go ahead, do it, it's okay, you can administer the jolt. They want it. People will, from pressure, from searching, from approval, will do endlessly, endlessly stupid, self-sabotaging things. And most, even in not those cases, most of the time the things we get from the world don't, because they're outside, they don't address the inner stresses, the inner feeling of emptiness, the inner feelings of lack of purpose. There's no way something or someone's words out there can make in the long term you feel less stressful, less uncomfortable in your own skin. Nobody can do that for you. The best people can do is distract you from the fact you feel uncomfortable in your own skin. So these solutions are very short term. One good thing about the feeding metaphor is that it also lends itself to the idea that if we cook our own food that we grow, we can be sure that it's healthy. By which I mean, if we develop thoughts that are worthy, like compassion, generosity, goodwill, like we practice in the meditation, if we practice being patient with people and forgiving, if we practice being forgiving with ourselves and patient with ourselves, if we practice relaxing the body with the breath and being aware of the areas we hold our stress and relaxing those, that's like cooking organic food that you've grown in your own backyard. I live in Brooklyn, so it'd probably be pretty weird eating food that I've, if I even grew food in my backyard, but you get the idea. You can be sure of what you're consuming is good if it comes from within, because you can have control over it. Whereas if your sense of peace of mind is contingent upon getting approval from other people, not only is that not going to last very long, but you're setting yourself up for one of those days when they're not going to give you approval, when they're going to be in a pissy mood and they're going to criticize you. And suddenly you're going to feel even worse, because we're so attached to feeling okay by getting approval from other people, that suddenly when they're not approving of us, we're even in deeper shit than when we started. The same thing with money. If we get our sense of security from how much money we have, experience shows that money can disappear pretty fucking quickly. There are huge financial institutions even where I saw people who used to work there for 20 years with boxes walking out, you know, Lehman Brothers and all that. So it's not like there's any lasting security truly in the world that can make you feel truly, truly a sense of self-esteem or a sense of peace. You can't get that. You can't buy that. It's not something that can come in a vial or a pill. I mean, it can help sometimes, but it's not going to be the lasting solution. So another metaphor, of course, is one of my favorites that Ajahn Jeff always uses, the metaphor of the house. The windows are the eyes taking in information, and the door is like the mouth, you know, things can come in and out through the mouth. And so there's constantly stuff coming in that we're searching for to make ourselves feel okay. And then there's also, in Asava, there's things that we're doing. We're saying things. We're trying to get even. We're trying to say the perfect thing so that people will love us, and do the perfect thing so that we'll get approval. So there's this constant flow of information coming in that we're picking up, and the things that we're doing as well. And so the issue with restraint is, how do we gain control over all the stuff that's coming in and going out? Like, one of the simple messages the Buddha said to his monks is, learn how to close the windows when it's cold and open them when it's nice outside and it's warm, and it's nice outside and it's too warm indoors. Well, this sounds like very obvious advice, but really what the Buddha was saying metaphorically is, learn that you don't have to constantly find all of the security and all the sense of okayness by looking and searching for it outside. For example, when my dad was very, very, very old, he still would have hours and hours of the news on. He'd have watched CNN for hours. And just be in a state of constant stress, because all the news really is in America is just constant drama. Mm-hmm. Constant drama to get you hooked. If you ever watch, when I look for the news, and I'm not saying you should become Luddites or, you know, people that hide your head and not be aware of anything, but I generally tend to watch the BBC. And it's amazing how much calmer my life is just by that. When the world is never ending on a daily basis if you watch the BBC. But if you watch American news, you're amazed that there's even a tomorrow when you wake up. It's like they have you on the edge of, or me, I should say, they have me on the edge of my seat. You know, you read the newspaper and it's just stunning, it feels, that we make it year in and year out with that endless catastrophes, financial, otherwise, destroying everything. So, just being, having a sense of knowing who we're going to listen to, where we're going to focus the mind, how much we're going to focus the mind on things that bring stress. This is a huge beginning for practicing restraint. The mind very often is like a vacuum cleaner. It tends to vacuum up anything that we put in front of it. The problem is, good vacuum cleaners, which would be all of them, I guess, you can empty out the garbage that they suck out. The human brain is a little different. You can suck up absolute shit that's totally unimportant, and you will carry it around for the rest of your fucking life. I'll give you an example. At some point when I was a kid, I thought it was important to know everything about all the rock bands that were going on. I still know who the saxophone player for Roxy Music is. I have his name embedded in my mind. There's no earthly use for knowing that. There's actual brain cells going to that fucker's name, and I cannot get it out. And it's not like a vacuum cleaner where I can simply, you know, it's like a Dyson where you can take this thing out and rinse it out and it goes away. You can't do that with your brain. A lot of the information you take in, it's in there. It's hard to shake that shit loose. I wish I could say that in meditation, that's the time where you flush the toilet and all the names of rock bands that you no longer give a shit. Well, I like Roxy Music, but there's bands that I don't give a shit that I still know the name of their songs. And they're stuck in there. I know the names of sports players that were big when I was a kid. And they're all stuck in there. And all these events that are just cause stress when I remember them, they're stuck in there. Actually, clinical studies show, and neuroscience shows, that the things we remember are the things that, there are two kinds of things we remember. A, things that occur when we're very emotional. There's a part of the brain called the hippocampus, and it tends to record for long-term storage in the temporal lobe things that are happening when we're really angry, really frightened, really sad, in any really emotionally charged state. On the other hand, stuff that occurs when you're not emotional at all, when you're calm, doesn't get stuck in the mind. It just happens, but it doesn't get lodged there. The only other way you can stick something in the mind for long term is by sheer repetition, by rote. And that sticks it in a place called the striatum and other places for long term storage. So those are the two things. If you expose yourself day in and day out to the same shit, that'll get stuck. Or B, if we're constantly emotional, constantly craving, constantly uncomfortable, what we experience will be lodged in there, and it will become triggers that will cause us suffering later on. The more stressful stuff you have in the mind that you've recorded, the more stress you'll experience later on. I'm going to move my leg. Here's an example. People who experience a lot of stressful rejection when they're young, a feeling of not being loved or appreciated by their parents, later on in life, when they go through rejections in relationships, can be utterly destroyed by the experience. You might know somebody who's been in a relationship for a week, and the relationship breaks up, and they're destroyed. And you're trying to be very compassionate. Yes, we've all been through it. But a part of your mind's going, the week you've been going. That was a week. You started dating last Saturday. It's been 8 days. Can you really be this destroyed? Well, it's because early in life, the vacuum cleaner was picking up a sense of rejection. I'm not good enough. I'm not loved from the outside. And it gets triggered. Now, to a certain extent, when we're young, there's very little we can do about it. But as adults, adding more and more feelings like that into the mind by getting worked up and constantly emotional when we're trying to get approval from other people just causes more little mind landmines in the brain that can go off with each new experience. So part of the way to not pick up garbage or build up repressed difficult material that can sabotage us when uncomfortable things happen is by A, keeping yourself as calm, keeping the breath as calm as you can in life, keeping the body, the areas that cause, that hold stress, keeping these underlying areas, it's been shown this reduces the release of adrenaline and cortisol. And those are the neurotransmitters that turn on the hippocampus and say something's important going on. I'm going to remember everything that's happening right now, and I'm going to deeply embed it. There's an interesting study that when people go through car accidents in Sweden, they gave them immediately after the car accident, they would give them beta blockers, which would stop the release of cortisol. And they found that because they weren't releasing cortisol, they weren't having post-traumatic stress disorder from the car accidents because they weren't remembering any of the details. Because their body was calm, even though they'd just been in a horrific accident, by the fact they kept themselves calm, they didn't remember the horrific details and they didn't have PTSD as a result afterwards. So it's a very, very useful practice in life when you're going through a disappointment, when you're going through something that's possibly stress-inducing, that you're worried about the long-term effect of the experience, is to find the breath, relax the breath, find the body, the areas that are stressful, and relax it. Just these two techniques, in and of itself, by restraining how much we're attaching to the world and bringing attention to the body and relaxing it, reduces the mind's tendency to suck up and swallow everything. It gives you a choice in whether you want this stuff that's occurring to be with you for the long term. There are some other really wonderful tools that the Buddha gave. there's also, when we're going outside to feed on the world, there's practicing remembering impermanence. I'll give you an example of how this works. I have a great weakness for Apple products. My friends will testify to this, that whenever there's a shiny new Mac out there in the world, especially the new 11.6-inch MacBook Air, which is now has me in a nearly perennial obsessive state that I have to work with by relaxing myself, when I see it, I literally have to remember impermanence, which is A, in 4 years after I buy any computer, I am bored to shit with it. They have a 4-year lifespan before they are no longer the fastest, shiniest thing on the market. They're now the grubbiest, slowest, oh my God, I can't believe you're working with a G4 type thing. So, but also, with anything that we're craving, it could be something that's beautiful, a beautiful suit, a beautiful person, anything that we think is going to solve everything that's causing the mind obsessiveness is to remember impermanence. What is this thing going to be like in 10 years? Is it still going to answer all of my problems? Is it still going to be the thing that it looks like today? Is it still going to release all this excitement in me? No. Just reflecting that everything eventually doesn't have that same spark that it had when you first saw it. That has a tendency to change our relationship with things going out there. So bring a sense of remembering that everything's impermanent. The second thing is, look at things not just in terms of the surface, but what's underneath them. Famous example of this is the example that monks have always given, which I find sort of hilarious because it's sort of difficult to do, but if you see somebody that you're lusting after, they say, and you can't have them, or you're just craving after something, imagine what they look like on the inside. Like, does their liver really look that good? You know? You know, when they're taking a shit, when they're pinching a loaf, whatever. Are they attractive? Is that, you know, really going beyond just the shiny exterior and looking what's within it. Now, you might not want a picture of the person that you're obsessed with like that, but it's helpful more with things that, you know, cause, like, whenever I try to look past the shiny exterior of that Mac Air and just imagine just the chips inside of it and the fact that they're just a bunch of little chips and it's really nothing that's going to solve anything for me, then it's less attractive. Another thing that the Buddha taught is looking at the world with a sense of karma, which is a sense of remembering in the past, did this thing or something like it ever solve everything for you? Did being, you know, did buying that for me, that last computer or that last gadget, is that the thing that made everything good? Is that the thing that gave you lasting peace and comfort? No. Bringing that reflection that, no, I've never actually gotten from anything in the world lasting purpose, lasting peace of mind, lasting sense of security. Reflecting so that the idea, again, is not to become completely indifferent to the things of the world. In fact, we can enjoy the world and we can enjoy our relationships and our friendships and the people. But if we're not trying to get from these people and these things lasting inner peace, lasting security, lasting of okayness, then we can really, really be in good relationships that are not about sucking the other person dry, needing to control what they say and do, because I need you to say I'm good all the time. So going out into the world, reflecting on impermanence, seeing that things are just, are not only the shiny exterior, but they're made up of many different parts that aren't always so attractive, and reflecting that these things have not in the past always brought us the lasting solution to our stress. These are three very valuable tools for when we are engaging with craving in the world. And the exact same things go with when we're angry. When you're really, really angry, it's good in reflecting that ever telling someone off or shouting at somebody, did that ever solve? Did all the anger go away? Did that ever bring you lasting peace? Reflecting on that. So the other part of this equation is that, and I'll just be quick, not only is it about getting restraint, about getting things from the world and how we can bring a new attitude to that, but it's also about, as Ajahn Jeff says, it's also about, just as there are dangers outside that can trigger our anger, can trigger our self-centeredness, and we have to be careful, can trigger our fear, like Fox News. Just as there are things out there we have to keep sometimes the mind guarded or closed off from, we have to be wise what we're looking at, who we're interacting with. Not only there, but there's also stuff inside of us that we don't necessarily want to let out. We all have pit bulls in our minds. Most of the time we keep them well fed and they're happy little pit bulls. But once in a while, the little pit bulls in our minds get really pissed the fuck off. And we really, really want to let out on anybody. And so you wouldn't just, if you had a group of really, really angry, underfed, undercared for pit bulls in your house, you wouldn't want to open up the door and just let them loose on the world. At least I hope none of you would want to do that. But very often when we're really stressed out, we're really uncomfortable, we feel really frustrated, We go out into the world and we look for the first person that does even the slightest thing wrong so we can let the pit bulls out. And this type of action never brings long-term happiness. It never brings peace and a sense of calmness in the long term. All it does when you let out on someone, you let it all out, is that you feel shitty in the long term. It's not something that ever solves anything. For the short term, just like feeding on approval, feeding on sensual pleasures, feeding on popularity, for the short term it'll give you a bump. For a short term, yelling and screaming, it makes people feel like they've done something in the short term. But in the long term, all it does is breed more need to vent, more tendency to shout, and it doesn't get rid of the underlying stress at all. The stress that, oh my God, I have so much to do and I don't have enough time to do it and people are not understanding that, is never solved by shouting or getting even with someone or letting out the pit bulls within us. In fact, what does make those inner feelings go away is breathing, relaxing the areas that get tight, and focusing the mind on the first most skillful thing we can do, and putting the rest of all the other stuff that we're carrying around, putting it away, and just focusing on what I have to do next. That does work. Taking it out on other people doesn't. Finally, another kind of dog we have in the mind that we don't want to let out as much as we do, I know this is going to come as a shock to some people, but it's the little love me, love me, love me puppy dog. The little don't you love me? I'll do anything you want. Look, I'm a little doggy. I'll jump up and down for you. I'll jump through a hoop for you. I'll lick you. I'll do anything you want. We all have that little love me, love me, love me dog in us. And just as we let out the pit bulls in us, we also let out the little doggy. Because if I'm really, really wonderful and nice and lovely and everything, you'll give me the love that I really need and make me feel okay. Now, I'm not counseling you to be indifferent or cruel or just completely caught up inside. All I'm saying is that both of these tendencies are all about the idea that the solution's going to come from outside. When you're here at Dharma Punks, you can be certain that everybody is here for a skillful purpose. So we can just say hi and then go into, you know, finding the breath and be comfortable. We don't have to win the approval. You don't have to win my approval. I know that you're all here trying to find peace. That's why I'm here. So we don't have to impress anybody here. We don't have to make anybody here say we're okay. The way we're going to find out we're okay is, in fact, by simply being compassionate with ourselves, by developing thoughts of generosity, by relaxing the body, by appreciating the skillful things we've done in our lives, by appreciating the times that we've shown up for people, by reflecting on the teachings of whatever spiritual path we're practicing, by making the breath as calm and as peaceful as we can. Those are the things that make us feel okay in the long term. My doing jumps through hoops for you and winning your saying, oh yeah, you do a really nice backward leap, don't you? That's not going to last. That's not going to last. So we be as compassionate as we can, but we always keep the focus on what's going on inside. Am I peaceful? Am I relaxed? Is the breath comfortable? And then when we interact with people, it's from a balanced place. It's not from a place of, I need you to make me feel okay. So that's restraint. And I hope you got something out of it. And now is your time for questions or thoughts. Thanks for listening.